I guess the thing that surprised me most about the study, now I've just seen the synopsis that was out this morning just for the state of Kentucky, is that we've been hearing around here that coal mining is in decline and will continue to decline in the coming years. But this study predicts, now of course this is quarrying too and oil and gas extraction, that it's going to be growing by 23% over the next 7 years. Am I drawing the wrong conclusion there, that it's actually healthier than?
No, you're not drawing the wrong conclusion. But you know what I'd actually do is this. First of all, where are we starting from? Because 2010 is actually our base year, we might be starting from one of the deepest declines that we've seen in decades. So once you're at the bottom of the barrel and the bottom of the pit, the only way you're going to go is up. So that could be part of what we're seeing as well. And once we separate each of the categories, oil and gas extraction and mining and quarry, then we might get a different synopsis. But we do, in fact, see a growth in the jobs created. Granted, it's not that much. It's not that many because the industry itself is relatively small compared to, let's say, education services or healthcare for the state. But we will expect some amount of growth, at least compared to 2010, in those jobs by 2020.
That's right, because, I mean, that's the mistake us reporters make is when we look at percentage growth, we sometimes don't look at the size of the industry. So a big growth doesn't necessarily mean the industry will be a big player in the economy.
That is exactly true. And in fact, it's probably easier for you to grow if you're small and if you're large. You can add on a larger number of jobs for a big industry, let's say like healthcare. But even if you add a large number of jobs, it doesn't mean that you're going to really impact or grow quickly compared to the size of that industry to begin with.
Well, what I thought is interesting then is then if that's the case, just counting the number of jobs, healthcare remains one of the prime movers in Kentucky's economy. It looks like
in Kentucky's economy, and I for the rest of the nation, healthcare continues to grow for many reasons. It's still 19% of GDP, so almost $1 in $5 we spend is spent on healthcare. The healthcare and social assistance as an industry is comprised of several healthcare occupations as well as non-healthcare occupations. But even by occupations, professional and technical and healthcare support occupations will grow very quickly in Kentucky. One concern in healthcare support would be the types of wages that healthcare support jobs attract. I always highlight that as a cautionary point because healthcare support occupations, the wages for those have actually been stagnant. And their career pathways and career lattices for people who are in healthcare support occupations are almost non-existent. So when you get into that occupation, it's really difficult for you to sort of jump that huge divide over to healthcare professional and technical occupations, which have the better wages and salaries.
And again, I mean, with the sequester going on and government budget cuts, government is still going to be a major employer in the state with a 13% increase, adding almost 300,000 jobs over the next 7 years.
Sure. So government continues to be a major employer. And that differs by state. And it really depends on what are the composition of those government jobs. In the case of Kentucky, government jobs also tend to be high education jobs. So people with, bachelor's degrees and master's degrees and associate's degrees tend to, aggregate a lot more in government jobs than others. And even with sequestration, we did a separate study a few months ago that looked at the composition of the losses we expect from sequestration. And we found that the vast majority of those losses were actually in high-skilled jobs. But even so, for some states more than others, government continues to be a major employer. I just want to point out one thing. During the majority of this recession, so let's say we're looking at 2007, 2008, 2009, the only two sectors that continued to grow really were in healthcare and a little bit of government. So government held on a little bit there. And then More recently, we've noticed that government is slowly but carefully reducing the size of its workforce across the board, so for the entire nation. At some point, we would expect that, you know, to level off and for us to see at least a marginal increase in some of the workers.
I guess the only sector that's in decline seems to be agriculture, forestry, fishing, and hunting. Can you give me any cause for that? What's behind that number?
I want to talk about agriculture, and I want to talk a little bit about manufacturing as well. So although we see, you know, a 3% growth rate in manufacturing or a negative 6% growth rate, a decline in agriculture, what's true of these two sectors is actually productivity. So what's happening here is that we might notice output from the sectors to be growing. So the sectors are actually doing well on paper, but you can achieve so much more with less workers. So the workers that remain tend to be highly skilled workers who, you know, are working in a much more technologically advanced field. The type of work they do right now is highly mechanized. So the need for, you know, more workers to do that job is actually declining. And we like to say of manufacturing, for example, that it's a victim of its own success. So when you compare the productivity of a manufacturing worker today, each manufacturing worker contributes about $100,000 to output in real terms compared to maybe 30 years ago. $300,000 in real terms compared to 30 years ago when they contributed about $100,000 in real terms. So each manufacturing employee in those terms, in real numbers, is actually three times as productive today as he was 30 years ago. But we have, you know, a much lower percentage of our workers in manufacturing. So as the enterprise becomes much more mechanized and we increase productivity, then one of the challenges with that is that we use less workers to do so.
And I'm a little unclear about education and its impact on job growth. I guess I kind of had expected that the need for post-secondary education would grow in Kentucky, but it seems still that more jobs will be created for people with just a high school diploma than with any other kind of diploma. Why is that? Is that because of retail or what?
So let me just get that. That number, because there's no state for which there are, I mean, the highest proportion of jobs still remains for those with post-secondary employment and above. So let me just get that
that's true here. I mean, I see the majority, probably what, two-thirds, almost 60%.
Right. So, for Kentucky is actually 62 by 2020.
And so what I'm trying to figure out here, what kind of can I take away from this report is that we need more education, we need less education, we're doing just fine. Give me some context, if you could.
So here's a little bit of the context. So in the case of many, I mean, all of the states, you know, the national average is about 65% of all jobs in the nation will require some sort of post-secondary education and training beyond high school by 2020. So that's beyond high school. It includes post-secondary vocational certificates. It includes certifications, industry-based certifications, associate's degrees. It's not just, you know, we don't really necessarily talk about a college degree from the perspective of a four-year bachelor's degree. But what we should take away from this is that if you're looking at Kentucky and you find that, 62% of the jobs in Kentucky will require some type of post-secondary education and training, then the immediate question would be, well, where are we now? And the percentage of workers, the current attainment rate for workers in Kentucky with some sort of post-secondary attainment level, at least for the prime-age workforce, is close to about 54%. So there's a gap there of about 8% between where we currently are, the attainment rate of the workforce, and the attainment rate of the jobs that are coming for the future, for 2020. So the concern is, how are we going to fill those jobs? Are we going to fill those jobs because, you know, the workforce is going to get the acquired skills between now and then? We certainly don't see this based on current trends. Are we going to import the workforce from elsewhere? The implication of having a workforce that's not, you know, the qualifications are lower than the types of jobs are endless. The jobs can actually move. Those highly educated jobs, those jobs that require high levels of education might move to a place for which it finds the workforce is better suited to the job. Or we can actually import workers from elsewhere to do the job. So the question is, to what extent can we create the types of policies required to ensure that citizens of Kentucky are qualified to do the jobs that are coming?
So what you're doing is you're projecting demand, and it's up to the people here in the state to figure out how to supply that demand.
That is correct. We're projecting demand. We're looking at the industrial composition of the jobs, which industries are projected to grow fastest, what types of occupations are required to fill those jobs, and then what's the level of education we need tomorrow that's required. And this level of education might be the credential, but it's also, you know, a competency-based system. I mean, what do you have the knowledge, the skills, and abilities to reduce the skills gap or to reduce the skills shortage that so many manufacturers, so many business and industry interests seem to talk about?
You threw out the figure 62% earlier. 62% of employers will need somebody with greater than a post-secondary education. How does that compare with other states? What's that say about the employer, the average employer in the state of Kentucky in the year 2020?
Well, the way it compares is we can say, for example, that Kentucky is about 3 percentage points below the national average, but it's actually higher than, you know, many of the neighboring states. So if you think of states in the south, and Kentucky is actually doing pretty well. Georgia is at 65%, and then, you know, so many of the jobs are actually found in the metropolitan areas for that state, so that's part of it. Texas is about 62. We also have Mississippi at 61, Arkansas 59, Louisiana 56, West Virginia 55, Tennessee 58. So compared to some, you know, of the other states in the South, Kentucky is just about one of the – it's going to create jobs that are going to require much more education than some of its neighboring states.
And one final question. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being naive, but I look at this, and it leaves me feeling hopeful for the economy in the future. I mean, am I just being silly?
No, I think we should always have hope. If we have hope, then you know, and creativity is lost if we don't have hope. I mean, hope encourages us to always seek better alternatives. And I think, I mean, if you have no further questions, there are a couple of economists, Rogoff and Reinhardt, who I always turn to when we're talking about what happens after recession. And they've spent a lot of time analyzing all of the recessions that occurred after the Great Depression, every single recession. We've had, you know, booms and slumps since the Great Depression. And what they found is that financial recessions, such as the one that we're just recovering from, financial recessions tend to be painful. Financial recessions touch every single facet of the economy, every single facet of life. Everyone feels the pain. It's a credit squeeze. It's a credit crunch. Everyone feels the pain. But the recovery from financial recessions is no different from any other recovery. I mean, we might go into a very deep hole, but after we get out of that hole, there is a rise. And, you know, rise is slow and the rise is steady. So we have to expect good things. And the challenge is to make sure that, you know, we tell our children about what we ought to expect. White and Rubio has a bill out there right now called The Right to Know Before You Go. If we're going to make this huge investment in education because we recognize the importance of education for us attaining middle-class status, then we need to ensure that all our students actually know what the potential benefits are for that education. What can they do with that education? What types of jobs can they secure? What type of wages can we secure with that education? And that information should, you know, or should always be available to us so that we can make better decisions. And education, you know, does not become a burden around the neck of the student who's engaged in it.
Dr. Smith, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.